Brothers Wiss. The Brothers Wiss, Brothers Wiss. The Brothers Wiss. The Brothers.
You're now listening to Greg.
Hey, everybody. This is Greg Soule with the Brothers Wiss, number 79. I am, again, Greg. I'm down here in the motherland, Texas. Tonight we've got Mikey all the way from Chicagoland.
How's it going, guys?
Excellent. And maybe some of the other bums will pop in later. I don't know. We'll see. I'm not going to hold my breath. Two days after Thanksgiving. So everybody's kind of all over the place. So I don't blame them. Just the dedicated few here. Holding down the fort. So let's get the new patrons out of the way. So we do have a Patreon, patreon.com/thebrotherswisp. If you join that, you get access to our Patreon only Slack. Tons of good discourse in there. I think we've got, what is it, Mikey, like 50 people in there, 60 people, something like that?
I'll take a quick look. The general channel should have everybody. There's been 74 people in general channel.
All right, there you go. So it's a lot of good stuff all the time. You know what I really like too is a lot of questions answered. So you can pop a question in there and then have like a live interactive conversation with somebody to solve it. And then you've got all these different people from different angles, different backgrounds, different use cases, all throwing their ideas in there. Very politely throwing their ideas in there. It's a good place. But our new ones for this round, we have Colin McAllister, Jeff Martin, Lee Alamand, Andrew Kaiser, Steve Carter, and Brian Monday. So we've got quite a few new soldiers in the ranks this go around. So you ready to jump in with some of the news, Mikey? Because I know
sure.
It's been we skipped a cast, so we've got a little bit of stuff backed up. First on the list is Ubiquity's doing 0% financing now. What are your thoughts on that?
I loved. I don't remember all the comments, obviously, that I saw when I posted that that news. But some of what I saw, I thought was pretty hilarious. Some guys were saying, making comments about their inability to keep things in stock. So what good is 0% if you can't buy it in the first place? And then, of course, there were some people talking about, there's always someone to complain. Usually it's me, but there was a, $5,000 minimum. I think they need to be in business for 5 years as well.
Ah.
I think so. They're not financing startups.
It says 0% APR offered is based on applicants' qualifications. So, yeah, there's a vetting process. And it says it's 0% APR for 24 months. So you get 2 years to pay it back with no interest, which is not bad.
Yeah. And so there are obviously, some downsides to it. Like, it's most likely going to be MSRP, and most places sell to you under MSRP. So can you get financing for some amount of percentage, whatever it is, and still pay less than this program?
Right. With the interest going through a distributor that's going to give you a really good discount, actually save you money over paying MSRP I see what you're saying. Yeah, it's interesting.
I've done nothing on the math on it, so maybe it is, maybe it's not. I do see so it must have a commercial location for equipment use. I guess it's to exclude people just buying stuff out of their house. But then I run my Wisp out of my house, so I guess I can't participate. And then one thing I do see here is that it looks like one thing that can be tough for financing is that it looks like they will look at your business credit, and if it's not sufficient, then they look at your personal credit. Because it says personal credit is also looked at if applicable. So it sounds like if they don't like what they see at just business, then they'll, you know, dig into your personal finances.
Gotcha.
But if not, it sounds like they'll do it without. And, you know, I see this being real useful for, or somebody else financing it for all I care, in like the MSP type space, where it's like, you know, you can do this big build out, you're going to charge people X amount a month for like a managed infrastructure product. Now you don't have to worry about where you get your money from to do this gigantic, you know, build out a school or build out or whatever, you know, building out some office complex. If your intent is to charge per month for the access points, you know, now you don't need to figure out where you're going to get, you know, pay for all of it up front.
Yeah, fair enough. I guess it's more or less the easy button is what you're saying, as opposed to going out and finding your own financing and doing all that. You might be able to find this a little bit simpler.
Sure, sure. Yeah. And, you know, maybe I'll just have to look sometime and see, you know, talk to Brian over at Maltech and be like, hey, you know, I know you, like, I believe they're partnered with somebody that does financing. You know, just tell them, hey, I don't want to buy it. Just, you know, what would it look like price-wise? Just so I can compare how useful this Ubiquity Finance program is.
Yeah, for sure, for sure. Sounds interesting.
That I would hope for the distributor's case that the Ubiquity program is worse. Because it means you know, you build a channel and then you compete with your channel.
Yeah. Well, so, I mean, if you're honestly and truly competing with the manufacturer, you're never going to win, right? Because they're making it so they can set the price whatever they want. So yeah, there has to be some detriment, some downside to it.
But I do believe historically the Ubiquity store has been MSRP, so I think that's kind of where, you know, if the finance guys don't take too much money, you know, hopefully they'll still make it out.
Gotcha.
Ahead.
And even if nobody really takes advantage of this, it was one more thing that the marketing department could push out, you know, because like our marketing guys are always looking for anything to start doing media blasts about. So, you know, just
sure
drums up buzz, you know, get a few new faces looking at you. Maybe investors get a little bit more excited about it. Due to, you know, just the extra hype. I get it. I see what they're doing there. I see you. All right. So let's go from Ubiquity over to MikroTik. The newsletter 85 came out, which actually was a minute ago. It was new as of when we should have done the last cast. So it's a little bit old, but, there's a couple of new devices. I think this had already been announced. The CRS 305 1G 4S plus IN. It's basically a, 4-port 10 gig switch that's got a copper gig port on it, which I think is pretty cool.
Yeah, and it's $150.
Yeah, it's list price. It's got two DC inputs on the back as well, so dual power, and then it's also got PoEn on that copper port, so you theoretically could maybe have three different points of power on this thing.
Yeah, and so, you know, MikroTik once again has proven how cheap it can be to build an SFP enabled product. The core of my issue is that, you know, it's not expensive to add SFPs to devices if, you know, their 1 gig version of this is, I think, $50.
Yeah.
You know, so, you know, if the MSRP on a product has 5 SFPs on it is $50, then it can't be that much to add it, you know, cost to add it to an existing product, you know, to another product. You know, here we have 4 SFP pluses in a product that's $150. If your licensed, you know, backhaul radio can do more than 1 gig, stop with this lag stuff. Stop with giving me a whole bunch of 1 gig ports because it just makes it more complicated. Just put a 10 gig port on it, because obviously they're not that expensive. If the whole product is 150, you know, 149, and the licensed backhaul is going to be thousands of dollars. So,
yeah, they're saying this little guy, maximum power consumption is 18 watts. So I'm wondering, I'm guessing these SFP Plus slots, you could probably slide in regular SFPs. I think you could do that in a lot of their equipment. I'm not going to say that definitively. I'm not sure, but you probably can. So you could probably bring in the 10 gig and then bop out 1 gigs from it if you wanted to. So it'd make a really nice kind of pop device, you know, if you just didn't need a lot of density and or you're just trying to do the layer 2 transport there. I can see it being extremely useful. I can actually think of a couple of different places where it would be useful for me. And I like the form factor. It's not necessarily rack mountable, but it's very compact. So you could throw this thing on a shelf. You could screw it to a wall. It gives you a lot of options.
It, and I see that they talk about it being dual boot, and I've only met one person ever that liked Switch OS. That's so great. Why? Yeah. Why do they continue to do
that's the
it?
First, that's the thing I thought. Yeah, it confounds me why they bother with the dual boot stuff on anything really. Nobody likes the Switch OS.
On their original products, like on the original, like the was it the RB250, which was the first one that had the Switch OS. I think it was their first one that would do line rates, anything, because I don't think they had, you know, hardware switching functional yet in router OS. So the first ones I get, but now that you can do line rate switching in router OS, why?
Yeah. Well, let's see. Scroll down a little bit, and you see they also have the LHG LTE kit. It's basically a 17 dBi LTE antenna. So they're saying speeds of up to 150 megs by 50 megs. So really, this is kind of your rural. I bet this would work, too. Like, if you're in the middle of a building and you can't really get reception, I bet you could strap one of these in there, and it would do the trick.
Sure, yeah, considering that like most cell phones have a functional equivalent of 0 or negative dB of gain because it's a very low gain antenna inside of a device.
Yeah.
17 dB is going to be a lot of gain. it's just unfortunate that they don't support, they have a really small band support.
Yeah. Supports international LTE. That doesn't mean anything for us, right? LTE bands 2, 4, 5, and 12.
Yeah, and you know, in my previous Microtech LTE rants, I've mentioned that like all of these bands are part of other bands. Why didn't they support the whole thing? Why is it like, you know, it's like their 5 gig stuff. You know, they don't do DFS, but they'll do all the other 5 gig. Why don't you just support all the 5, you know, I mean, 5 gig at least, you know, it's a little more complicated because they have to develop the DFS functionality in router OS, but
yeah.
Here it's like, why didn't you just do the whole thing? Why'd you half-ass it? But this will be a very popular product.
For sure. All right. So moving right along, while we're talking about Microtech, they've announced the US MUM, and it's going to be in Austin, Texas. Man, that's in my backyard. And I actually went on, you know, the Microtech and logged in, and I voted for Austin. So I am super glad that they're doing it there April 4th and 5th.
Wait, what are you talking about voting for?
Yeah, you could vote for the city that you wanted the next MUM in.
Where? When?
Well, it's too late now, obviously. But
obviously, but I've never heard of this. Where's this at? Like on the forum, or is it in like, the special trainers section or something?
I think
something,
it's just when you log in. I think it popped up and asked you, like when you logged into your account. I can't remember 100%. But yeah, it's gonna be in Austin. It's gonna be a good time. I love going to Austin. I know a lot of fun spots, so I think it'll be really cool to hang out down there. Plus, man, depending on where it's at, it's like an hour and a half drive for me. So. Super stoked about that one.
I'm so blown away that like I've never heard about voting for this is at, and I'm complaining about their choices all the time, and no one's ever told me that I could go vote for where it actually is.
As far as I know, this was the first year. So.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
I don't know. We'll give it a go next go around.
It's in the Austin Marriott South. It's on 35.
If it's off of 35 and it's south, yeah, that's probably not too bad. That's going to be probably pretty close to downtown.
And I'm zooming out from OpenStreetMaps. That's their default link. Yeah, it's not too, yeah, like it's just, do you know where 71 is?
Nah.
Or 290?
Yeah, I know where 290 is.
It looks like it's just south of 290 and 35. Or wait, no, 290 is 35 there. They just, I don't know.
Yeah, they crisscross.
It's just a little bit south of downtown.
All right, cool. That'll be really close to all the good stuff. Let's see. Miller had a birthday. Everybody say happy birthday to that kid. Something else that happened in the news, IBM acquired Red Hat. So I know I'm a big CentOS fan, so I have no idea what that means for people like me. I'm assuming this really doesn't mean anything for the next, what, 4 or 5 years?
Yet, well, you know, CentOS takes forever. Well, you know, Red Hat Enterprise takes forever to do anything anyway, so even if they change something now, you wouldn't notice it for years. But, yeah, I don't think, like, I don't view it as badly as, say, Oracle buying Sun, which owned Java and MySQL. Like, I don't look at it that badly because there's not, like, an existing competing product, really. I mean, IBM has stuff, but, you know, they're not in the, you know, they're not in the community with a Linux distribution. So,
yeah, I've got
maybe
a
they're just
of friends
looking
that
to monetize.
Work for a couple of the teams for Red Hat, you know, like on the consulting teams and stuff like that, or proof of concept teams. I wonder what it means for them. I hear it's not always sunny working for IBM, you know, very corporate overlord infrastructure sort of thing. And Red Hat, from my understanding there, it is like super open. They treat their employees really well, very loosey-goosey sort of thing. They apparently have like this one big email distribution list that anybody in the company at any point in time can send an email that everybody else sees, right? And it goes up to the top to the bottom, and there's like discourse on everything, which I think is pretty cool, but I wonder if that kind of stuff is going to stay.
That's interesting, because that could be potentially very dangerous.
Yeah, well, yeah, some people say it's very annoying. You know, but you filter that stuff out and ignore it if you want. But I thought that was cool that, you know, the lowest guy on the totem pole can send an email that the CEO will see, you know, and
yeah,
and possibly react to if it, you know, has enough discussion. I think that's fairly unique from what I understand.
It looks like in 2017 they made $2.9 billion. And Red Hat, that is, and IBM continues, in my opinion, not that I follow them a whole lot, but they continue to decrease in relevance. So I would imagine that, oh, somebody makes money, let's buy them real quick before.
Well, I know probably, I don't know, 9 years ago in the data center, we had, I don't know, probably 20% of the equipment in there was IBM, you know? So the IBM guys were in and out pretty frequently. And I would say now maybe 0.5% of the equipment is IBM. It's basically been purged from every, you know, like every cage in our data center. Nobody uses IBM like hardware wise anymore. And I know they're bigger on what, like the managed services and stuff like that, but I really don't know
that
if any of our people inside really use them either though.
It they must be because they have 366,000 employees as of 2017.
That's crazy.
So there's a lot of IBMers doing something.
Yeah. I'm not the guy to talk to about that stuff, but it's interesting. What does it mean for the community as a whole? Who knows?
And then looking here, it looks like Red Hat had LibreOffice, OpenStack, GNOME. So there's a whole bunch of things other than just Red Hat Linux that they did. But I imagine most of it has to do with trying to get more into, you know, Linux managed services stuff. Yeah. What I assume.
Well, I mean, you see with acquisitions as well, sometimes they'll take the parts they want and sell off the parts they don't. So it doesn't mean it's going to stay intact the way it is now. They could just, you know, if there's redundancies, you know, we already have a department that does this or that. They might just let those people go, which sucks. For them.
Sure, when Broadcom bought Brocade, and like they ended up selling all of the manufacturing. Basically, they just bought them to get their intellectual property, and then it's like, you know, they spun out, you know, data center switches to Extreme, and you know, business switches and Ruckus to Aeris. They spun something else out to, was it Viata? They spun out to AT&T. It's like they just sold off every piece of Brocade other than their intellectual property.
Mm. Other than just the handful of pieces they wanted.
Which begs the question, why don't they just buy the, you know, why don't just buy the IP and leave the rest of it alone? I don't.
All right. Well, while we're talking about acquisitions, Airspan Networks Incorporated just acquired Mimosa Networks Incorporated. Well, I say just. That was, what was that, like 4 or 5 days ago?
Is that what the announcement was? I'm not sure.
I think so. It was around there.
I heard about it before, but.
Yeah.
But.
So Airspan is traditionally like 4G, 5G manufacturer, right?
Yeah. So I remember several years ago, they were coming to the WISPA shows, you know, pushing their, I think at the time, their 700 megahertz product, 700 megahertz like WiMAX. This is how long ago that was, when that was a thing. And then they kind of disappeared from the WISPA space. Then all of a sudden they started popping up doing a lot of small cell stuff. I think they're powering most of Sprint small cells. I'm not sure who else is using them, but yeah, they're doing a lot of that kind of stuff. So I did see that Airspan and Mimosa had a partnership several years ago on some special device.
Hmm.
So it kind of makes sense that, you know, they're, you know, that, you know, they picked them up, you know, 'cause they already had a working relationship. And it sounds, from what I've been hearing out of Mimosa, it sounds like it's largely going to be business as usual with more resources.
That's interesting. Yeah. I mean, from the one of the press releases, they're saying something about, you know, they're keeping the distribution chains. They like the way all that stuff's going. They like all the partnerships that Mimosa has made thus far. Says they're going to, you know, just overnight double their portfolio, you know, a whole new market to sell to, which makes sense, you know.
Sure, sure. And, you know, I'm guessing they probably didn't make a whole lot of inroads on the initial WISP push. And, you know, that could be also part of the, you know, now there's all of this CAF money out there, people having to build stuff. So maybe Airspan's trying to be, hey, you know, we've got some LTE stuff, we've got this other Mimosa stuff, we, you know, trying to be more things to more people. Yeah.
Well, I mean, also know, you know, if you've never heard of Airspan and they're trying to send you or sell you some equipment, it's going to be a lot harder than if Mimosa just rolls out a new piece of gear. You know what I mean? So they could just rebrand some of their kit as Mimosa, and then it's a name you know and trust, and you know you've been using their kit for a while, and it just rolls right into your portfolio. I can definitely see how that works.
And you know, others do something similar. IgniteNet and EdgeCore. You know, IgniteNet switches are EdgeCore hardware, because they're owned by the same company. Acton owns both, so IgniteNet switches are just EdgeCore switches with, and from what I understand, the OS is basically the same, other than IgniteNet has spun out, you know, adding all this cloud connectivity stuff and, you know, kind of, you know, customized it a bit for their niche. But if EdgeCore tried to sell the WISPs, nobody knows what the hell that is. But everybody knows IgniteNet, whether they can use them, you know, use their, you know, main, you know, 60 gigahertz brand or not, you know, they know who they are. So, you know, that helps move some of their other company switches.
Yeah, makes sense. All right. So I see you added a thing, but I actually had it deeper in the list. We'll kind of roll it into that one. I pulled some stuff, which I love doing now, is just, although it's kind of tedious because there's so much conversation sometimes. I go through the Slack, through the various channels, and just kind of pull stuff that looks interesting out. And so let's see. Jeff was saying that Huawei, once they actually developed some U.S. distribution, that it ended up raising the prices and stuck the documentation behind a paywall. So he wasn't necessarily happy about that. I guess they got more responsive in shipping things as opposed to it having to come all the way from China. I guess that's one benefit, right, of actually having local distribution. But I think he said he can still purchase direct from China if he wants, you know, kind of the AliExpress, Alibaba route.
Sure, yeah, you know, that makes sense. And I assume that most people on Alibaba, either it's used stuff or it's fell off a truck or something. I assume it's not through official channels.
Well, I don't know. They may be less discriminating over in China. If it's, you know, a Chinese distributor that's purchasing it, you know, they might just give them a big, nice wholesale discount and not think about it.
From what I understand or stood, like all the stuff that is behind the paywall now was out in the open before, but it was like bad. It was like bad English translation. It was just, you know, like, you know, they just ran the manual through Google Translate and said, okay, here you go. And it sounds like the stuff in the paywall is...
I think Huawei's been kind of notorious for that forever, right? Is somewhat questionable documentation.
Well, no, see, like on the original Huawei stuff, it was great documentation because it was just the Cisco documentation, find and replace Cisco for Huawei and call it a day.
Yeah.
Because they had the same errors, like, you know, the same errors in the documentation in both sets. Mm-hmm. So it was stolen documentation.
I wonder if they ever missed any find and replace and it still said Cisco in there.
Maybe it's, so. I'm sure it happened.
I've actually heard that before. I've heard about Huawei. Who was it? So it was HP bought, what was it, 3Com? Is that right? And 3Com,
I think so,
had bought routing from a partner company of Huawei. I can't remember the name of that company, but they were manufacturing line cards that you could literally take and shove into like a Cisco 6500 chassis. Like they would slide in, the color coding was the same, and even the pinout on the back, it would mate in to the board. That's how copy and paste the hardware was. Pretty. I don't know that the line cards would actually power up, but they, I mean, for all intents and purposes, they were the same line cards, which is crazy to me that they could, you know, get away with that, but whatever. That's above my pay.
You know, I assume that somebody at the factory just stole the plans, went to a different factory, and so, okay, make this, only change the logo on it.
Yeah, there you go. Oh, man, that's crazy. All right, so something else. I think you actually brought this one up, Mike. It was discussing running fiber along with copper and MDUs. So even if you're not going to use the fiber now, why not go ahead and run the fiber right along with the copper, right? Wasn't that kind of – I'm trying to remember what the conversation was about. Is that it?
Sure, yeah. And so, you know, my thing with MDUs is that I want to run copper – because I want to do PoE to the in-home router,
right?
Well, in-unit router, so I can provide a service that nobody else can. No other service provider, unless they're also doing what I'm doing, but, you know, which is not very popular or common. You know, no one else can reboot the in-unit router. You know, full power cycle, and. Then obviously, then, you know, no one else can also provide backup power to it unless they get everybody a UPS, which is, you know, scale is just a cost problem at that point. So I wanted to run copper, and someone else was saying, you know, fiber. You know, I think it was Adam Bell. He works with Justin Miller. I think he was saying that all the property guys, you know, they get all excited about fiber. Regardless if they need it or not.
Oh, yeah.
That's what,
well, marketing,
you know,
wise,
that's
it
what
sounds great.
Makes them excited.
Yeah.
You know, you can tell them the same solution and to substitute copper for fiber, and they'll want the fiber one, despite being the same thing. So he said, you know, I forget the actual brand name of it, but it's, you know, bend insensitive fiber that they you know, work with mm-hmm. is cheap. I think it was like 30 cents a foot. It's like, so just run the fiber there because it costs more to go back.
Oh, yeah. Well, a lot of times it's impossible to go back, you know?
So just, you know, run the fiber with it. And then if, you know, at some point down the road, you know, you want to do fiber, you know, you have your copper there doing the PoE thing, and you could use fiber to do data at that point.
So I guess the understanding is if you did actually go to the fiber, you'd transition to some kind of PON, not like a active Ethernet?
Some people do one, some people do the other. You know, that's what the great thing about fiber is. It's there, it's available. Do what, you know, do what you want with it.
You can figure it out at that time.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, because, you know, doing a home run for the fiber in MDU, you know, you're not having miles of extra fiber. It's just, you know, the few hundred feet back to the you know, closet. So even if I did pond, I'd probably still home run everything back to the closet, where then I have the splitter there.
Yeah, yeah. All right. So moving right along, somebody brought up the fact that they were getting ready to do the network for a customer, and I can't remember if it was the customer or the cabler or somebody, or maybe he was the cabler. I can't remember 100%, but basically the customer was convinced that they needed 10 gig to the desktop for a standard office environment, and they were sold on it that it had to be 10 gig. And so we started musing over the fact that what kind of environment would actually need 10 gig and take advantage of it. And I know I've seen it, like, when I've done the lynda.com stuff, like the producers, like the production team, they all have 10 gig to their desktops. But I mean, they're doing heavy video editing like all day, every day. So, I mean, that absolutely makes sense to do it in that environment. I can't think of too many other environments where you'd really need that much throughput to the desk. And I guess my thinking was this customer was probably just sold on it so that the vendor could make a few extra bucks, right? On selling hardware.
Yeah.
I mean, can you think of any other rationale why you'd want 10 gig? Have you seen anybody else talking about 10 gig to the desktop?
I know of, like, some WISPs that have done 10 gig to their desktop.
Yeah. Oh, wow.
But not to everybody's desktop. Just to theirs. That way then they get, you know, the 10 gig speedtest.net test on their computer. But no, that's all I've heard is that, and then, you know, video editing and, you know, big GIS stuff and, you know, design, you know, engineering and video editing, I could see. I don't agree, but I'm not going to argue too much.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But everything else, it's like, I mean, everything else, it's like, you're probably fine with 10 megs. I mean, because it doesn't take a long time to open up a Word document.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So what?
Well, I mean, your average office user, you know, they're just pulling small files. You know, they're pulling email. They're not doing anything intensive. It doesn't really matter.
I had one of my consulting clients before. If somebody had, like, there was slowness issues, this one guy's thing was swap them out to a gig phone. I'm like, no, like, they're working with files that are under 10 megs. Like, 100 megabits going through the phone is not the cause of their 5-minute bottleneck. There's some other bottleneck in the system. It's not the phone. Swap, you know, it was just the default thing of, you know, if this problem exists, swap to a gig phone. It's like, you're wasting time and you're wasting phones. Stop.
Yeah, well, I mean, the disparity in price is pretty slim these days as far as 100 meg versus a gig. You know, there's not that big a difference. So yeah, it makes sense. But if you have to change out 50 phones to get them all to gig or something like that, yeah, that does actually make a difference in price. So I get that.
To me, like, it wasn't even the price thing. It was just like, you are wasting troubleshooting time with this because it's not related.
Yeah,
get it is not going to fix the problem. Move on. And they swore it did, and it never did.
Yeah.
It never did.
Well, while we're talking about speeds, we had somebody, and this rolls, I mean, this comes up probably every month and a half or so. Somebody was talking about MikroTik B test, you know, bandwidth test results to routers. And so we always say, if you want to test, test through the router. Don't actually do the bandwidth test to the router that you want, you know, to see what the throughput is, right? Because the bandwidth test uses a single CPU and it's going to max that CPU out and then it'll stop throughput wise. I think, what's the consensus about TCP 250 megs? That's on average about how much you can get before it maxes out one of the CPUs.
I think it depends on the platform, because like years ago, I think it was 617. What I think was the, you know, latest stable, like actually stable firmware at the, or router was at the time. But I had that on a couple x86 boxes, and I knew I wasn't going to test the links to their maximum because of the, you know, overhead of B test, but I just wanted to see what would happen. And I got 30 gigs running B test from one box to the other. I had four 10 gigs, and my problem was that B test was on the same core as like Ethernet, and so it I could figure out how to, you know, do some sort of process affinity to move it to a different core so that I could fill it up. But so I mean, you know, B test can do a lot. It just takes a lot of beef to make it happen. You know, that's one, you know, one dual socket Xeon to another. But they, you know, they've been pushing for years to use this traffic generator tool, and I've tried it a couple times. It's nowhere near as simple. It's complicated. It's like, so I always resort back to B test. Yeah. It's like, until they make traffic generator as simple as B test, I'm probably not going to use it.
Well, most of the stuff I'm testing is pretty low throughput, so B test works just fine. I have used traffic generator pretty successfully. Something I like about it is it lets you DDoS people if you want. you can just fire hose at somebody. So it's actually really good for that.
And I believe it produces a lot more information and a lot more useful information than just this is how fast it went. And I would like that, but it's not just type in the IP address, you know, credentials, and, you know, choose what direction you want the traffic to go. There's a whole lot more stuff, and so I say move on.
All right, let's see. Next topic was invalid packets in their MikroTik. This could be one of the things was runts, so that's packets that are smaller than 64 bytes. Technically, there should be no packets smaller than 64 bytes, so it'll drop that. Another one is if packets show up that aren't in the connection table, you know, and it's not a new connection, then those are considered invalid. Also, you know, like if you're having a communication and one side closes the session and then packets continue to show up in that chain, those are going to be invalid. So it's not always the worst thing in the world to see a few of those here or there, right? So say you have some asymmetric routing in your network, you might see it. You know, if you've got a lot of redundancy, you might see a few spurious ones kind of fly through. So it's not always the craziest, worst thing in the world.
Yeah, and it's, you know, I've always... You know, one of my top couple rules has always been just drop it valid packets. Just drop it and move on. You know, only if we got it to hand did I ever dig into it any further.
Yeah, I've never had any problems with it. Let's see. Thomas also noted in a different thread that modern versions of router OS do MSS adjustment directly in the PPP driver to allow a packet to stay in the fast path. So apparently it used to create a mangle rule automatically to do it, and now it just does it directly in the driver, so much more efficient than it used to be. I can't remember why that came up, but it did, so there you go.
And you know, anytime you can keep something in fast path, you know, the better. Obviously.
All right, so I had somebody who was using a CCR to terminate a couple thousand PPPoE clients. It was also doing NATing, and it started choking whenever 20 to 30 clients would drop and reestablish at once. And the client said that this generally happens because their area has bad power. So a tower would just, you know, lose power eventually, or a neighborhood would lose power. So all those customers would go down and then reestablish. And then there started to be this just CPU spike and these cascading sort of failure in the microtik. And so the answer to that one was to split out the NATing from the PPPoE termination, and then everything just started working fine. I guess it was just a little bit too much load for it. I think it was a CCR 1036. So it is what it is.
And I see, like, I know there's a bunch of people that are doing this sort of, you know, thousands of sessions on one device, and I don't understand the logic behind it. Like, why are you passing a device that can do it to put all your eggs in one basket? Like, I guess I understand.
Because I've had this conversation multiple times with multiple people. And generally what I like to do is those PPPoE servers, the concentrators, I like to distribute them throughout the network, right? So each tower could theoretically be a PPPoE concentrator right there. So
That's what I do. Yeah. Every session stops at the tower.
Yeah, and it's not like you go and make wide sweeping changes to these things very often. So having them in place is fine. And it also distributes the load, right? So that local router is doing PPPoE termination. And generally in your radius, you can pass back an attribute that says, you know, set them to this rate limit. So not only is the PPPoE being terminated there, but the customer's rate limit is terminated all the way there towards the edge at the tower. So that router is only getting lightly loaded, as opposed to, just like you said, having all of that pullback to a single point and that joker having to do all of the queuing, all of the termination, right? Because it's having to constantly maintain these sessions. And that's going to be CPU intensive in certain scenarios like this. You know, and if it's your border router, you're also going to be doing your NATing, and you're going to be doing your firewalling, you know, so it's just, that's a lot of load to put on a single device, wherein if you kind of separate all that stuff out, you know, even if you have five towers doing concentration, you could still have one radius server, right? That is, it's not changing that at all, you know?
Sure, yeah. Like, you know, I think, you know, radius, which is obviously very old, but then radius and then, you know, various types of automation, you know, through Unimus or whatever, you know, to me, eliminates any usefulness from these mega concentrations. Like, just push it all out locally, because you have that centralized radius that you can make redundant. You know, and you know, any other changes you need to make to like the profile settings or whatever, you just do it in Unimus. It just does it on all your routers. Yeah. Like, I understand that there's more things to touch, but you shouldn't have to touch anything like that anyway. Do it in Unimus once, just if you're doing it on your one concentrator, like, or insert your,
yeah. Well, I know,
you know, automation tool of choice.
So
but
I had this conversation with Thomas one time, and in his network, he's got like five PPPoE concentrators. So it's not just one big one or one big one with a backup. He actually does it with several, and they do it in this specific way because they use a lot of micropop sites. So that micropop may only have like five users on it, right? And then that may daisy chain to another one and then to another one, right? And so it could get a little complicated in there. So in lieu of that, he VPLS tunnels all of those connections back to, you know, the whichever one is regionally close, and then it has a backup, you know. So it's sort of a compromise in between the two. And so I see why he does it. But I think that's not a super common use case for most of the people, at least here in the States, right? Normally you have a tower that's going to service, you know, a good chunk of customers, and then that's going to then connect to another tower that's going to be a good chunk, as opposed to the kind of micro pop that he does. So
sure. But you know, that style is getting more common with, you know, cause now I think Mimosa started kind of, you know, well, obviously micro pop design was before that, but yeah. Mostly came out with the micro pop products. And now others are doing MicroPop product as well. You know, Cambium's coming out with, on the roadmap, I saw like a MicroPop type product for the you know, 450 product line. This whole, which it makes sense because, you know, WISPs need high SNR to have a good stable network. So either you have monster antennas or move it closer, you know, and, or do both, I suppose. Rory Conway, you know, he's got hundreds or thousands of, thousands of users out in Phoenix area. Phoenix is probably easier to do micro pops than, you know, I'd say Mississippi because there's flat. No foliage.
Yeah.
you only intend to service a few hundred yards or meters, and this is all you intend on serving from this access point. And then you use 24 gig backhaul to wherever your bandwidth is at. But that makes really stable client connections, because if you can't, with a 25 dB dish, overcome interference at a few hundred yards, you're probably not going to overcome that interference with anything.
So earlier you said SNR. What is that?
Signal to noise ratio. How much you can hear what you want to hear over things you don't want to hear.
Right. It's like the concept of in a noisy room. If you scream at the guy next to you, he'll probably hear you, right? So your signal is louder than the noise around you.
You can kind of observe this if you go to a restaurant and you're there all night long. Early in the night, it's real easy to talk to the guy next to you or even three or four tables away at a normal voice, assuming there's no overhead music that's just drowning you out. But then as the restaurant fills up with people and everyone's having their little conversations, that builds the noise floor. So then you have to talk louder to your intended target. So then everybody does, just runs away until the restaurant dies off at the end of the evening, and now you can go back to talking at a normal volume.
Fair enough. Very simple. All right, let's see. Somebody else had packet loss on a disparate switch network. So they basically had a switch network in building A and, say, a switch network in building B, and they were different sites connected over the internet, and they did a microtik EOIP tunnel, and every time they brought up that EOIP tunnel between them, both networks started getting packet loss and everything kind of went to hell in a handbasket. My tips on troubleshooting that is microtik EOIP tunnels. I've noticed before, whenever I'm connecting two Cisco switches together through an EOIP tunnel, for whatever reason, if you have STP on the EOIP tunnel, it freaks out the microtik STP process. And so if you ever see just kind of this weird intermittent packet loss, watch the STP on either side of that microtik on the Cisco devices, because I'm willing to bet you'll see one of those VLANs go into blocking state. And it may not be, so say you're sending 10 VLANs over there, VLAN, 1 through 5, maybe VLAN 5 will just shut down, and then it'll come back, and then it'll shut down, and it'll come back, right? So it's not always the whole link going down. Sometimes it's just an individual VLAN. So be on the lookout for that. That's bit me more than once before I've seen that.
And I wish there was, I wish Trill or SPB or one of those was more commonplace throughout hardware, so people would stop using STP. STP is garbage. That's why they made these new protocols.
It works in a lot of environments. I use it pretty successfully most of the time. Not to say that I wouldn't prefer something better, but
I don't remember the quote, and I don't remember the name of the person exactly, but it was someone who was involved with the development of STP said, "This sucks," so we made this instead.
Fair enough.
It solved lots of problems lots of times, but then it also causes lots of frustration. And there's better tools out there. They just don't always get incorporated into platforms. You know, MicroTik doesn't have Trail support or VXLAN or SPB or insert anything that any of the myriad of, you know, technologies that's better than SDP or RSTP or MSTP or any other variations of that.
I don't know. It seems like MicroTik's pushing more into the enterprise, you know, more and more, you know, with like the 4011s, you know, I guess because that feels more like an enterprise device than kind of a home router. I don't know. It you know, it's got an SFP plus interface. I don't see a lot of home users getting one of those. So it feels more enterprise to me. So it just seems like the more they push into enterprise, the more they'll start taking heed to those sorts of commentary, you know, like, hey, give us the enterprise protocols to go along with it.
And I think, you know, I think they've moved to newer chipsets or better chipsets that have support for this stuff built in, so they're not trying to do it all in software on some, you know, crappy Athros, you know, switch chip that was only meant to be in a home router. And, you know, they haven't developed all the functionality yet, but, you know, they're, you know, all the tools are there now where they can in, you know, in these new CRSs and whatnot. You know, I believe the protocol of choice now is VXLAN. I saw somebody post something the other day. I think I just shared it on Brothers Wisp past day or two. So, you know, some presentation from RIPE where they were saying that VXLAN is dead and, you know, this is the new one. It's like, we're still moving to VXLAN. Like that's still so far away for us, and you're saying it's dead already. but, you know, there was some discord on that, you know. You know, whatever.
Yeah, there's always something new, newer, shinier, better, right? It's like,
that's things that, like, stable. Yeah, it's a, well, like, I guess on a tangent here, you know, I've got switches that have 40 gig ports. And so I'm looking for 40 gig waves. They are a thing. And, you know, this one transport company said, you know, we really only want to sell 10s and 100s. Like, we usually sell 40s for the same price as we sell 10s. Even though I know the equipment, you know, it will do 40s, and it only uses, you know, 4/10 of a 100 gig wave in the spectrum. They sell, you know, we would rather just sell you a heavily discounted 100 gig than 40 gig. Well, I'd rather buy that too, but my switch doesn't take it. So now I have to go from buying a $1,000 switch to a $6,000 switch just to be able to plug it in.
Yeah. And that's what our vendors were telling us probably a year and a half, 2 years ago. We'll sell you a 1, a 10, or a 100. We don't really want to do 40s anymore.
Yet, I'm really starting to like, as much as I don't like Cisco, I'm really starting to like these Nexus 3064s. You know, they've got an assortment of 40 gigs on them. You know, they have 48 10 gig ports on them. And, you know, we can get them with the current iOS for like $900. And they have, you know, VPC and all those other things that, you know, VPC, we can kind of do like a, you know, like a ghetto Trill arrangement type stuff with it. And it's like, we could do all this stuff with it and it's $900. And, you know, I'm looking at, you know, I want something just a little bit better than 10. You know, I'm going to buy a 10 and then fill it up and then not have a problem. So how do I solve this? Well, FiberStore used to have this little device where you plug in some 10s and some 40s and it spits out 100. You just put one on each side and away you go. Well, the blog posts are still there, but the product is not. So it's like, so now I'm looking at, you know, what's the cheapest way of getting to 100 gig now? And it's, you know, those switches are $6,500.
Yeah. While we're talking about it, you were asking about a white box switch that can do a massive amount of ACLs, right? So this would be the same device, right? 100 gig plus massive ACL count.
It was different use cases, but it could, you know, because on the one hand, I'm looking for something just to move bits into a wavelength from one IX to the other. You know, trying to take some of the content we've been able to get in Indy and kind of help some of these new IXs get started. You know, kind of break some of that chicken or egg cycle. The high ACL one I'm looking at for to make a poor man's DDoS scrubber for, you know, doing transit services. You know, and people on, you know, I asked you on Nano, of course, I got all kinds of responses of that were worthless. you know, they kept saying, well, you know, what you want is FastNetMon or was it Andrisoft? I forget what their product was right now. Yeah. And it's like, no, that's the other half of the solution. That is what identifies what packets need to be dropped. That's
detection.
But they don't do the dropping. They still just send it off to some other device to do it. And, you know, if you've got a real DDoS, so, you know, you've got hundreds of thousands of things you need to drop. Because I'm, you know, I'm trying to go beyond the just do a, you know, black hole route and, you know, completely DDoS. You know, I want it to, you know, push into the switch a, you know, drop this source IP to this destination IP and port. I want that to be pushed into the switch. That's why I want hundreds of thousands of ACL entries. And I look and I see it supports 4,000. Well, that's not going to do me any good. you know, DDoSes are much more than that. So I'm still looking. It doesn't have to be a white box. It could be anything. Just some people were saying, you know, that Cumulus can push it in, you know, through their API or through BGP flow spec, you know, into whatever hardware constraints the switch it's installed on has, which brings me back to the switch. You know, find me a switch that can do that, and I'm not finding it, at least not at levels I can afford.
Well, I know sometimes, too, some, like, Cisco Kit has the ability to rob Peter to pay Paul, so they come with like a default set of this is how many ACLs you can have, this is how many BGP peers, how many sessions, routes, blah, 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 blah. But then you can basically nullify some of those things, like if you don't give a crap about them, and then push those resources over to, say, ACLs. So the regular spec sheet may, I don't know if they'll always 100% identify that, that ability to, okay. I mean, it's probably not always ideal for most situations, but if you're really just pushing packets from point A to point B in a switched environment, and you're okay with, you know, stealing all of your QoS resources and stuff, you know what I mean? Because you're probably not prioritizing VoIP traffic and stuff like that. And
Like, you know, these switches I'm looking at, you know, I plug in upstreams and maybe some transports and whatnot, and then, you know, my MikroTik routers into the switch, so that way I can, you know, do multiple routers, you know, on each session, you know, you're building some redundancy there. So I'm not using the device for layer three anything. I don't care that it does a million IPv4 routes. It's going to be used as a switch. So if I can take that million IPv4 routes and turn it into a million ACL entries, then that's the bam, sold.
So be it.
Because that's all I'm going to use it for.
For sure. All right. So if anybody has any suggestions for Mike, be sure to reach out. Let us know. Let's see. The next one was somebody was talking about how do you terminate your T1s? And the way I've always terminated data T1s is using just a regular Cisco 2621, like a 1U rack mount device. They are a million years old at this point, but you just get a T1 card in there. I'm talking about a total cost of probably $30 for all of that. On a bad day, that's $30. If anybody's interested, I'll whip together just a basic config that you guys can copy and paste on. Because it's I don't know any other more reliable or cheaper solution to do it. Because when you put one of those things in and they link up, they just run and run and run forever. Do you have any T1s?
Sure, my WISP has never had a T1. My WISP has never had any, you know, old school connection of any kind like that. But my consulting client with the CLEC, they've got some... Actually, they have a pair of 2621s or 2651s now, on some T1s, just doing SIGTRAN to SS7 translations, but I'm actually replacing them with 2811s.
There you go.
Which, because the DC 2621s are still expensive because there's less of them. So the DC 2811s weren't much more than the DC 2621s. So I just went that way, you know, because it's a newer platform, newer iOS, yeah. You know, newer everything,
yeah.
For not much difference in money. Yeah. And then
I think the 2800s too, and if you're doing voice services, like the PVDMs and stuff like that, they're just more powerful, you know, the digital signal processors and stuff, than the 2600. But if you're just doing data, like if you're terminating data T1, man, those 2600s are all you need.
I've got in there doing, so it'll have, well, actually, I got a whole bunch of the dual T1 cards because they were cheap. It's like, you know, just buy a whole bunch. And then I got some DSL cards. I got my DSL cards from Australia. It was cheaper to buy like 15 of them from Australia than it was to buy 10 of them here.
Huh.
Because they were just, it was like $5 a card. Like, I'm guessing somebody in Australia just wholesale got rid of thousands of these things, and just one, you know, shipping was like $80 instead of 10. But, so I just ordered a bunch of the cards to make it worth, you know, worth the difference. And so I'm, I got a couple with async ports on them too. So my intent is I have this 2811. Some of them have T1s, actually most of them won't, but they'll all have DSL cards. They'll all have the you know, async serial in them. And then I get a DSL from the incumbent. I use the async serial to then do console ports on everything that has a console port on it, so that then I have a way into my network, you know, or, you know, a way into this location that's completely off net, and I can get into a console to do whatever, you know, reboot whatever switch or router it is that's there. And, you know, some of the T1s also do some of that, you know, SIGTRAN to SS7 translation. But, you know, there's a million ways of doing it, but these are all in CO, so they have to be NEBS compliant and, you know, minus 48 volt DC. And it's just ended up being the cheapest way I found to do it. They're about $250 a pop for all that.
Well, it sounds like most of it done.
Most of it's in the cost of the 2811 DC, but whatever. Mm. Which, Cisco built it so the power is on the same side as half of the ports. So it's like, and the power is all in the back on everything else. So we have the first one we installed is actually in the rack backwards to keep the power on the right, you know, the back side of the rack.
Yeah, Cisco's usually don't, like, especially the older kit like that, doesn't put out a lot of heat. So, you know, even putting it backwards, that's not that big a deal, honestly.
Yeah.
Let's see. The next and last one we had was Steve, I think, was trying to grab L2TP sessions going from his MikroTik to a specific client. He wanted to do policy-based routing, right? Like violate the route table. And he was trying to mangle it and put routing marks on it. It just wasn't working. Turns out you need to put that mangle on the output chain, because anything sourced from the router, like I'm the router and I'm sending it to somebody that's leaving the output chain. He was doing it on the pre-routing chain, which it would never actually get seen because it leaves the router before. So pre-routing happens, all that stuff. And then somewhere in the juicy middle, output chain happens. So he moved those marks over to the output chain and Bob's your uncle. And then he was good.
Yeah. And as complicated as it is, you know, MikroTik always has packet flow diagrams.
That's right.
That show everything definitively. This is where this happens.
Yeah. But be sure to look up the V6 packet flow diagram, which is different than all the previous ones.
Yeah. I think they do change occasionally. So it's good to refresh that from time to time.
Yeah, for sure. But yeah, there were two questions that got answered, I think 10 minutes apart, and they both had everything to do with the V6 packet flow diagram. Like, hey, this thing happens in this order. That's why this thing is important, or why this thing's, yeah. So it's definitely, if you ever can't figure something out, one, ask it in the Slack, to check the V6, or maybe check the V6 diagram first and then ask in the Slack. Maybe that's the simpler answer.
Sure.
All right, Mikey, we've hit the hour mark. You have anything monumental you need to discuss?
So I'm going to call him out on the Slack just to kind of pressure him to do what I'm looking for. So I sent an email over to Brian at Baltic. You know, at the Whisper Show, you know, we did the, you know, 411 versus CCR.
Oh, yeah.
To see, you know, what would load tables faster. Well, now there's all kinds of other, like, you know, that was just a real quick and dirty thing. I'm looking to go to Baltic someday and do much more comprehensive tests. You know, lots of sessions and, you know, how many sessions can we load up on the 411 before it dies, because it doesn't have a lot of RAM. And, you know, try to vet some of these, you know, what can you do on a CCR with BGP and what can't you do, you know, before it falls on its face. And so I'm kind of looking to see what sort of, you know, seek some input from people, you know, what kind of tests they want to see, what kind of hardware they want to see tested. It's reasonable. Somebody suggested testing some map lights, and they don't hold a full table. So, no.
They hold hard. they hold almost nothing. I think something interesting is when I made that BGP lab, something I found is routers that when they run out of RAM, they just stop loading the table. So they have some kind of hidden protection mechanism built into them now, so that before, because I remember before I used to play this game where I would turn it up on like a RB150, the full table, and it would just crash and burn, and it would reboot and then come up, crash, burn, reboot. And now they've actually put in a protection mechanism where if BGP gets too big and it's consuming too much RAM, it just stops loading the table right there, and then the router will keep passing packets. So at least they've done that much. So you can, I guess you could see how many routes a map light would hold before it just stops. But it's not going to really do you a lot of good.
So, you know, I'm seeking input. It's what people want to see. I'm hoping that I can just, you know, one day just go over there and just set everything up and do all these tests in one day, you know, do some screen recordings, do some video. You know, kind of put some substance behind, you know, claims made about BroadOS and BGP. From everybody, you know, I make claims too.
Right. Trying to put something very scientific together, right? Where it's reproducible results in the same environment. And yeah, so you can say apples to apples, this is how everything loads. Yeah, that's definitely, I smell what you're cooking.
So yeah, input, send it.
Send it. All right. Let's see. Mikey, if people want to get a hold of you out on the internet, how would you prefer them do that?
I guess patreon.com/thebrotherswisp.
You didn't say PayPal this time. You're mixing it up.
I'm getting busy. Actually, like, 3 or 4 of these things in the list of stuff from Slack I didn't even know happened. If you go there, then, Thin Brothers still gets money, and your problem will actually probably get answered. Well, I just leave it that. It'll get answered because I'm busy.
Busy. If you go to facebook.com/thebrotherswisp, that's where you find Mike. Truly and honestly, that's all the content that gets put up there is from Mike. Obviously, it's less than it used to be, but kid's getting busy. Can't blame him for that, right? He's hustling out there.
I just noticed this morning, I think there was like 3 or 4 messages that were like from like 3 weeks ago, or like links of things. I was like, oh, I guess I never saw that. Let's look at this link. Oh, that's interesting. Let's share that out.
All right, good deal. Yeah. So keep that stuff coming. If you're old school and you want to get a hold of us, you can also hit us, contact us at thebrotherswisp.com. If you want to get a hold of me, I'm at greg@gregsoul.com. I have that blog where I very occasionally post things, do a little bit of consulting here or there. I've been pretty busy lately, so I pick and choose, so no offense. But I do know some people, so I'm happy to pass you over. Even if you have something that's not in my wheelhouse or I don't have time for, I'll be happy to pass you over to somebody who does. But as Mike said, this Slack has been a godsend for me because I have more than just these six or seven idiots to ask questions to. Now I have like 70 idiots I can ask questions to. And in the collective, we are probably an average human being. So it's pretty great. Lots of different channels, so lots of good discourse. Questions do get answered pretty quick. You don't always get, you know, like the definitive clear cut, here is the exact answer. But a lot of times, you know, it's try this, try this, try this, try this. And in the course of those things, you know, you get to what you need. And I am learning stuff constantly.
Sure.
I know some guys in there are kind of lurkers, which is fine. But nobody's going to bite anybody in there, you know. We're not going to go to your house and kill your dog if you say something dumb in there.
I actually just saw like an hour ago a PetSmart. I'm not sure where it was, but at a PetSmart store, this guy asked to pet this elderly couple's dog and then just stabbed it.
Oh my God!
I was like, what? That's. Yeah, that doesn't happen in the Slack chat.
Just say, well, you weren't there. You don't know what the dog said.
I don't. I didn't even read the article. I was like, that's disturbing. Yeah, move on.
That's pretty crazy.
Mom, do you have any ideas what you're going to do your presentation on yet?
No, I haven't even thought about it, honestly. That Mom presentation, when I saw the announcement, it made me think, oh, yeah, I got to figure out something to talk about. I usually try and go newbie and then more detail, then newbie and then more detail, you know, like 1 year after the other. I can't remember what I did last year, so I'll have to look. It's probably more detailed this year is what I'm going to go for.
Yet, I think Wilson's going to do his on internet exchanges, like what they are, and then what microtik configurations you do, you know, go over local pref and med and, you know, what sort of firewall changes you have to make to, you know, and, you know, stuff like that to bring in, you know, obviously some IX stuff, but then you kind of, you know, bring it into microtik, you know, what sort of custom things you have to do there.
Yeah, for sure.
To take advantage of it.
Well, I guess while we're at it, if anybody has any suggestions on topics to cover, throw them out there. You know, I'm always looking for
security.
Security.
Microtik security.
By obscurity. I think Thomas was talking about doing a security based one. And if Thomas is doing one, I don't have any business getting anywhere near it because he's gonna murder it. So I would just be wasting my time. I'd be wasting everybody else's time in that instant. But join the Slack. It's patreon.com/thebrotherswisps. Get in there, add your voice to the chorus. You know, building a great community. Want you guys to be part of it. Other than that, questions, comments, contact us at thebrotherswisp.com, facebook.com/thebrotherswisp. See you guys later. Bye.
While you listen at work and we talk about equipment and methodology, so sit back and start learning. Lighting up the tower so people can start searching. Shooting up the web in neighborhoods, net surfing. We got horrible jokes, we're loud and annoying, but we're informative facts, we're not disappointing. Just give us a listen, cause fun is the mission. I'm telling you, you don't know what you are missing. Ideas and some good comedy given. If you missed the show already, don't worry, you're forgiven.